It's time for a listener feedback episode, and this is, like many listener feedback episodes, this is less listener feedback and more the things that listener feedback has inspired me to think about. But that's an important aspect of listener feedback. And conveniently, several feedbacks kind of started suggesting a certain avenue of thought, and it kind of, there was a nice little synchronicity there. So this one is mostly about sort of one train of thought, but as with many trains of thoughts, there are many branches. I'm going to start out with this email from Brad, who sent me a link, ariadnavigo.xyz/posts/whatthegnu. This was a blog post that's way too long for me to read on this show. It would be weird to do that. But the gist of the post, to sort of boil it down, was that this author, Ariadna Vigo, I guess, believes that Linux and GNU can and arguably should be split, separated. And not that they're together, but they often come together. And so much so that there is, or that I don't hear it so much anymore, but you do kind of hear it, you used to hear it a lot, I felt, which was that you couldn't use Linux without GNU. And that's kind of one of the main thrusts behind the idea of GNU plus Linux, or GNU slash Linux. The fact that when you refer to Linux, you might also say, you might also prefix it with GNU, because GNU is such an integral part of Linux, because Linux itself, of course, is just the kernel. Now, I've talked about this before, and I feel like I've probably gone sort of back and forth on it before, because, first of all, Linux, as I've said, Linux, that term, whether we like it or not, Linux doesn't just mean the kernel anymore. And I understand that it does mean just the kernel. That literally, that is what it means, but we can't control the fact that when I say, oh yeah, I run Linux, what I'm really talking about is my whole operating system, like the whole thing. I'm talking about the operating system, the desktop, the different applications that I run on it, the technologies from lots and lots of different projects. And there's that counter argument, right? Well, Linux, if it is just the kernel, then why single out just GNU? Like, why would we just say, it's the GNU thing, when really, if you look at it, it's GCC is what probably compiled the thing, yes, but I mean, then you'd have to prefix GNU in front of like 80% of the things out there, because GCC is used for a lot. I don't know if it's 80%, but you get the idea. And then you've got GNU, of course, really, I mean, what do we get from GNU these days? Well, we get GNU utils, and we get, you know, little libraries here and there. libc, that's kind of a big one. So yeah, there are some really, really important low-level things that, you know, the quote-unquote Linux developers, and by Linux developers, I both mean the kernel hackers and the people who kind of jumped on the bandwagon once the kernel existed and started developing for this crazy new operating system. They didn't have to come up with a bunch of stuff because GNU had already existed. So whether they knew it or not, some people believe, whether they know it or not, they were jumping on the GNU bandwagon. They thought they were jumping on the Linux bandwagon, but actually the bandwagon that the Linux bandwagon jumped on was the GNU bandwagon. Now that's all debatable. It just is, because there's a lot of question there about intent and you know, whether what does it mean to jump on a bandwagon? If you contribute to something, are you necessarily saying that you are intentionally contributing to a larger project, or are you just handing them some code? And what do you think you're contributing to? And if you say, well, I'm contributing this because the Linux kernel exists and has made such progress to being a desktop operating system, then in a way, maybe you're not contributing back to GNU. You're contributing to this project. So there's this big question of sort of identity and terminology and so on. But that was kind of then, and this is now. And now we do actually have proof of, not even proof of concepts, we have things that don't use the GNU core utils, even like the init systems and the libc, like those things have been cut out of certain distributions. I don't know how much of it's been cut out of, for instance, Alpine Linux, but that is one that gets cited in this blog post, that Alpine relies on BusyBox, and BusyBox has an init system. You can boot off of BusyBox. You can boot your Linux machine without systemd, without BSD style init scripts. It's just, well, you'd still need some init scripts, but you can boot it off of with BusyBox running as the init daemon. PID1 init BusyBox. It is possible. People are doing it. And there are alternate libc implementations. There's Musl and Run C and other things like that. So there are implementations out there of C libraries so that you can run all those low level libraries and applications off of, you know, off of these header files. So it's a reality. It happens right now. You can do it now. You can run Linux without GNU. And so there you kind of have to question, okay, well, is the GNU prefix now necessary because we're not running GNU on the thing, or is it still historically necessary because, once again, Linux wouldn't even exist as an OS if it hadn't been for GNU there at the beginning, and so on. And then you get back into the old argument of, well, what about intent? Like, if you didn't think that you were building a GNU system, but you happened to be using the free GNU tools that were provided to you without any kind of caveat in a license anywhere that you have to prefix your project name with the term GNU, is it necessary for you to call the thing GNU something or another? And the blog post goes on a little bit more about sort of how GNU is actually quite a bad implementation of POSIX, which I think in many ways that's almost, it's kind of inarguable in a weird way. I mean, you can look at things and just, you can look at the POSIX spec and you can look at the way that GNU tools, some of the GNU tools implement, you know, behave, and you'll see a difference. So you could say, well, that's just not POSIX. And in fact, there are flags in some of the applications like sed and tar. Or no, is it tar? Well, in sed, definitely grep. I think that's the one I was thinking of. That they're specifically flags that you can set just to be POSIX, to be POSIX compliant. So it's definitely not natively or rather naturally POSIX compliant in many cases, because there are options that you can use to ensure that they behave correctly if you are trying to be POSIX compliant. The question, at least the question for me, I don't know if that's the question of the post, but the question for me is, where does GNU fit in as we go forward with tools like LLVM or Clang and BusyBox and Musl and all the different projects out there that are re-implementing classic GNU tools in arguably cleaner and more efficient ways, and sometimes more POSIXly correct ways, and so on. And I don't know the point of that question, really. I just think that it is an interesting question, and I think it's a question that on the surface, personally, I don't care. Like, I don't really care whether GNU, the sort of the group of developers and that organization, whatever that is, I don't care whether they're in my next Linux distribution or not. I could sort of more or less leave or take them, and in fact, even, I mean, I think the one thing that I would not want to give up would be Bash. That would be sort of an application that I would not want to lose. Although, to be fair, ZSH is a pretty good approximation, so even that maybe not a big deal. But that is just on the surface. Because, yeah, functionally, as long as the system is the same and it's still open source, I don't really care what kind of sort of branding, low-level branding it has on it. But I do detect in posts like these, and I think we would be fooling ourselves if we didn't acknowledge this, but I do detect a licensing issue here. And whether the blog post doesn't really get into it, to be honest. The licensing thing doesn't really come up all that often in the post. That's not the central theme of this post. I mean, it is mentioned, but not heavily. And it's not saying I want to get rid of GNU because of the license. But I do feel like an open source system that loses the strong GNU licensing is going to ultimately be a weaker open source system. And I think that because we see that happening. We see it happening, well, we've seen it happen in BSD for ages. And if you want evidence of that happening in BSD, then I conveniently have a blog post from the maintainers of curl. And this one I do want to read some excerpts of. And keep in mind that this is not all the same train of thought, but it'll all come together eventually, I'm sure. So this blog post entitled, it's on daniel.hacks.se/blog/2021/09/25/curls-first-20-years-on-the-mac. So that is curl's first 20 years on the Mac from the curl developer. He says, Mac OS X 10.1. This was the first Mac OS release from Apple that bundled curl. It was a complete surprise to me as well when I realized this had happened. Nobody had told me about it ahead of time. I don't even recall anymore how I figured it out, as I'm not a Mac user and I've never had any direct contact with the peeps at Apple Inc., who were and are responsible for shipping curl on that platform. Not before then, and not after that either. So, and he says, the general consensus at the time seemed to be that Apple replaced wget with curl due to licensing reasons, as wget had been included in their previous OS 10 release. Wget is licensed under GPL, and curl comes under an MIT-like license. I'm not sure if they shipped libcurl 2 already at that point. So, right there, he's, I will say, correctly surmising, and I won't qualify that with how I know it's correct, but I will say that it is correct. He is correctly surmising that Apple has an aversion to the GPL and does attempt to get rid of as much GPL out of their code base as they can. He says later, I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's an interesting blog post from just an open source developer viewpoint. It is an interesting post that I encourage you to read. He says that under the heading Futile, or the subheading Futile Attempts to Help, for a while I reported security issues we found that would be relevant to Apple product security ahead of time before our releases went public, to give them time to react and ship fixes, the same way we send alerts to free operating system. I stopped doing that because, one, the Apple security people always complained to me for giving them too short notice to react, something like 2 weeks, which is also the maximum notification time allowed by others. And two, Apple never released any quick updates as a reaction to my notifications anyway. It took them months or years, making my efforts pointless. Basically, they were just rude. Subtitle, or subheading, nothing in return. Neither me personally nor the project have ever gotten anything or any compensation from Apple. Nothing. Nada. Perhaps Apple using curl early on was somewhat of a stamp of approval for some, which helped persuade others that curl is a tool to trust. Perhaps. Apple has not sponsored the project, has not paid for feature development, has not helped us with hardware, and never paid for support. They don't cooperate with us to help fix Apple-specific issues, nor do they ever report problems to us, which we know they must find occasional. Apple users who run into problems with curl on Apple's operating systems regularly contact the curl project to get us to help fix Apple's products. For free, of course. We never even get a thank you. I have a Mac these days, purchased with my own money, that I use to debug and test Mac-specific issues and problems. Apple is, of course, far from alone in this almost predatory behavior, but this post is about curl's 20 years of serving Apple customers. Also, yes, curl is open source and the license allows them to do this. We continue to ship a product that runs perfectly on macOS and other Apple operating systems. They continue to ship curl bundled with their operating systems. So that's what the developer of curl has to say about sort of his interaction, or lack thereof, with Apple Incorporated. 20 years of including curl on their operating system without a bug report, without a thank you, without sponsorship, without feature requests, without any of those things. So, well, I guess he doesn't necessarily say feature requests. He says they've never sponsored feature, they've never paid for feature development. I guess maybe they've requested features, but it doesn't sound like it. That doesn't sound like the case. So this is the kind of, and in his word, almost predatory behavior That's the kind of thing that a certain kind of license makes possible. And I think that I'm not saying at all that it's evil necessarily to follow the letter of the law of a license. That's what a license is for. That's the stipulation of how someone expects to be interacted with. You put that in the license, and if someone chooses to follow the licensing terms, which, you know, legally they're supposed to do or whatever, but just remove legality out of it, because that's just an imposed idea, right? Like, yes, we could use force to tell you to do things, but really, it's just, at the end of the day, we just have an agreement among people. And so you're putting a license file along with your code, and you say, I'd really like you to do these things. Now, Curl's license says you don't have to do anything, essentially. I'm simplifying. And Apple is following the letter of that license and not doing anything. That's a fair result. That's a fair interaction. That's what the license has requested that they do. Nothing. Obviously, something like the GPL, on the other hand, has stipulations. It says what we'd really like you to do in this, if you're going to use our code, is to make the code that you've changed available to everyone else under the same license. Now, in reality, people aren't forced to do that. Just because the license says to do the thing doesn't mean you have to do the thing. And we've seen that. We see it relatively frequently, not too frequently, happily, but, you know, there have been cases that have been brought up against technology companies because of licensing violation. They're clearly using some code, but they have not then made that code available, and that is going against the license. And so some people step in and ask for compliance, and if the compliance doesn't happen, then the legal stuff starts up, and people go to court, and people get sued, and it's really ugly, and wouldn't it be better if people would just follow the license? So the GPL, again, removing legality from it, the GPL requests that you make your code available, and it sort of encourages collaboration, and so on. And when Apple is forced to do that, they do it. And we see that. We've seen that before with KHTML. KHTML was KDE, the KDE's desktops, HTML rendering engine for Conqueror. And back in, I don't know, 2004, 2005-ish, Apple got a clone of KHTML and rebranded it as WebKit, and it is what runs most of the browsers these days. It is hugely an influential project. And, I mean, it's a pity that it got rebranded, I guess, but the history is there, and they have complied with the license and contributed back, and it continues to be an open source project and so on. So that's a big deal. And we see regularly, as with Curl, that the more permissive licenses simply don't get the kind of contribution that less permissive licenses do, especially from the bad actors. Obviously, if we're talking about just a normal person like you or me, dear listener, we're nice people. We want to help out. We want to share. All things being equal, if I make a change to your code base, I will happily send it to you. It's just, who knows, it might be helpful to you. Might not. You're free to ignore it. You know, that kind of interpersonal, like, real-world interaction, that's not the thing that we're codifying for. That's the easy stuff. But the real-life stuff, the big important stuff out there in the world that makes gears turn and smokestacks produce smoke and whatever else we're doing out there, we need licensing for it. We have licensing for it. And if you have a license that says do whatever you want, then bad actors who have no interest in contributing to the wider world are going to do whatever they want. And that's what we've seen. And I think that's my fear in this idea of, well, let's remove GNU from our system. As I say, I don't mind, and in fact, I quite like the idea of removing GNU from a system or two. That, in theory, I think is quite important. I think it would be great to have more distributions that were BusyBox-based, just for the low-level stuff. I'm not saying I need BusyBox to be the primary interface. I'm just saying, let's make that a thing. Let's have some distributions that don't rely on systemd to boot up. Let's have some systems that don't have that didn't use GCC to compile everything. And the reason that I'm interested in that is simply because a diverse culture is stronger than a monoculture. It's just, that's one of those base level truisms that I've come to recognize over the years. It's just kind of, that's the way it is in biology, as in technology, as in sociology. It's better to have diversity. The more choice, the better. Whatever kind of, whatever catchphrase you want to sort of invoke, that's what we want. And if we keep relying on GNU libraries for everything and the GNU project for everything, I think that's a weaker position to be in than having a lot of different projects to rely on. But I think the undercurrent, the possible undercurrent, and maybe I'm reading too much into Ariadne, the blog post here, Vigo, the blog post, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I think there's an undercurrent there of, well, the licensing is inconvenient. And what if we got rid of GNU to just kind of shuffle that license out of the way? Again, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's not, for instance, evil, but I do think that we have to go into that smartly. I think we need to be aware of what the implications of that would be. And if we're weakening the GPL foundation of Linux, I mean, the kernel itself is GPL and probably is always going to be the GPL. Not too worried about that. But the rest of the ecosystem, I am worried about, because I've seen a lot of progress. Just in my time of using Linux, it's gotten so much better at audio processing and video processing, and I mean, not processing, but like creation, content creation. I see it doing amazing things with containers on the cloud, and I see just system administration tools that just blow my mind. All of these, and Wayland, heck, Wayland over X. I mean, the never touch another zorg.conf file in my life. It'll be too soon. So, you know, there have been a lot of exciting developments, and I wouldn't want any of that to go away because there's less of sort of a GPL presence in the code base. And I realize that just having a GPL presence, like, that's kind of a vague thing. There are lots of libraries and lots of projects that use the GPL on a Linux system. And by Linux, of course, I mean the OS, not just the kernel. So I don't feel like sort of shuffling out GCC and GNU core utils and libc. I don't believe that would weaken, sort of like really weaken the whole system. I'm just saying, if that's the start of a slippery slope, let's just be aware that there's a slope there, that if we start shuffling things out and saying the GPL isn't all that great, or some equivalent of the GPL, it doesn't have to be the GPL, it could be, I'll put something in the show notes to this license, it's really cool, and copy left next, I think is what it's called. Some equivalent, sort of, you can use the code, but you have to give back. That's the foundation that I don't want to lose. And right now, the thing that stands for that the strongest is the GNU project, and I wouldn't want to lose that at the expense of, well, let's try a different init system, or let's try a different compiler. Yeah, let's do all of those things. Let's make our let's get a little bit of diversity in the way that we build our tools, but also let's hang on to that licensing and those principles that make our OS so strong. And let's have a cup of coffee, and we'll talk a little bit about systemd. Won't that be fun? Sip our coffee. I should mention, I should clarify that I wasn't trying to conflate the emailer, which was Brad, with the blog poster. Those were two separate people. Brad was the one who sent me the link. Ariadne Vigo is the site upon which the blog is posted. And I also don't want to read too much into the blog post. Well, I did read a lot into the blog post, so I guess I did want to read something into the blog post. Those were a bunch of thoughts that were sort of derived from the post. To actually get an accurate idea of what the post is proposing or is saying, you should read it yourself. I will say that the post's point, like the bottom line, was a little bit confusing to me. I felt like there were lots of different points being made, and I don't know that I could summarize what the actual point was. The literal last line is, I want cultish followings to end within the free and open source software community. I swear I'll always work against that. And I think that's always a good thing. The cultish following and the reactionary sort of reactions. What's a reactionary? Yeah. Reactionarianism. Both of those things, I think, are pretty unhealthy within the free and open source software community, which brings me really nicely into the next topic, which is systemd. There is a almost dogmatic rejection sometimes of systemd, which often puzzles me. We don't have to act this way. We can just say we don't like this system because we happen not to like it. We have the luxury of just arbitrarily not liking something. For a long time, I arbitrarily didn't like GNOME 2. I mean, I still don't like. I arbitrarily don't like GNOME 2. I do not like GNOME 2. Having said that, actually, there is a little bit of a nostalgia that is starting to develop. And when I use a desktop that sort of harkens back to GNOME 2, what is it, Mate? Is it Mate or Mate? Or is it Cinnamon? Or is it both? One of those two harkens back to GNOME 2. And when I use it, I always think, oh, this is kind of nice. I do remember GNOME 2. And now that I don't have to use it, there is a certain fondness for it. But for a very long time, I arbitrarily didn't like GNOME 2. And that's okay. I don't have to say that it threatens the very foundation or fabric of free and open source software philosophy. But anyway, let's talk about systemd a little bit because DeepGeek emailed me and talked about it. And apparently I talked about it in episode 430. I don't exactly remember what I said. I think I was saying that I didn't mind systemd. And he says it was nice to hear some positive mention of it. But he also says, I did, however, note the fears that BSD developers had over things depending on systemd as expressed in Hacker Public Radio's Linux In-Laws episode number 40. As many understand it, systemd is Linux specific. Also, I am fooling around with Slackware and did check and found no systemd binaries. On Debian, there is systemd and systemd's init binaries. I do believe that Slackware, being non-systemd, is remaining true to an advertised vision of being the, quote, most Unix-like of Linux distributions. I got curious and tested a few things on Debian. Okay, so this is Klaatu again. I want to pause there, and DeepGeek brings up an important point about systemd, which is the fear, which is often expressed, rightfully so, by the BSD developers, the fear that systemd is essentially fragmenting open source software, because you have software out there that's being written that depends on some component of systemd, and that component you can only access if you're running systemd. So in other words, there's a lack of modularity. And systemd, the developers of systemd have written before, I've read it online, I could probably find a citation for this, they've written before that they reject the notion that systemd is not modular, because they say, well, there's actually a lot of different projects within systemd, that's proof that it's modular. But of course, What they fail to sort of, I guess, acknowledge or admit is that those components are not independent of one another. They're very, very tightly coupled. So for instance, if you want to run journalctl, but you don't want to run systemd, you just can't do that. So journalctl requires the rest of systemd to work. And so if someone out there writes some really great software that relies on journalctl, doesn't do anything else with systemd, doesn't care what init system you're actually using, but in order to use, you know, some feature that application is using, in order for that to work, it requires journalctl. Well, now you've essentially said you have to install the entirety of systemd, because in order for journalctl to work, systemd needs to be installed. That may as well not be modular. That's not true modularity, at least not the way people expect. It might be modular by some definition of a development process, but for people functionally, that's not modular. And so if there's software out there that's being written that does rely on some component of systemd, and BSD cannot install and run systemd, then there's a whole piece of software out there that's open source that's useless to BSD. A BSD user could not run that because it needs systemd, and systemd itself is not compatible with BSD. Now, this is concerning to a lot of people, to some people, and my thoughts on it are not necessarily the most informed thoughts, because I don't develop against systemd. I don't develop on, you know, I don't develop systemd itself, and I do not build software that builds upon stuff that, that systemd uses. So very much a user experience kind of position that I have. But in my view, technology takes different paths. That's just how it is. That's what happens. It's a good thing. It's an aspect of open source that can be frustrating sometimes, and yet, in the end, is one of those great strengths of open source. I mean, it wasn't too terribly long ago that people were grumpy that there were two major desktops for Linux, KDE and GNOME, and it just seemed like, why aren't we just having one desktop so everyone can just work on making one really great desktop rather than two desktops that I personally don't like? I'm saying that as an example. I actually quite like GNOME 3 and KDE 5. I'm perfectly happy with both, actually. But pretend like I wasn't. And so people would think, thought and said very frequently, and people probably still say it when they first come to Linux, like, why would you have these two things? Neither of them are what I want. So why don't you just make one thing that answers exactly what I want? And that's a common misconception, that if you would just grab all the open source developers and force them to do the thing that, that you personally want, then Linux would be perfect. You see that kind of thing all the time, and it's not just in desktops. It's also on video editors, and it's on audio editors, and it's on graphic editor. Everything out there that people look at from the outside, they analyze it, and they say, well, this isn't perfect for me, and the reason that it's not perfect for me is because of fragmentation within open source. And to someone who's been living in Linux for a long, long time, one might look at that critique and sort of scratch your head, because that's just one person on the internet. There are lots of people on the internet, and every single one of them has different expectations, different desires from what Linux could possibly provide them. So there's just no way for open source to quote-unquote unite and sort of toe the company line, lots of air quotes all over around here because there's no company and there's not really a line, but that could happen. But then you just have one single thing for people to complain about rather than 20 things for people to complain about. And there are still other people on the inside who are enjoying all 20 of those things. So it's just how open source is, and I believe ultimately that that is good. Now, systemd exists. It is Linux specific, and that's kind of rough. It is a little bit of a tough thing to come to terms with, because it feels exclusive. It feels not very good to, certainly to BSD. But you know, I'm just not convinced that there needs to be feature parity between Linux and BSD. The differences between them can also be their strengths. And we've seen this before. BSD had jails for, I don't know, decades, I think, is what we found out in a previous episode when we actually looked into it. 1977 or something, they've had jails. Linux hasn't had jails. Linux has had cheroots, but that's not really the same thing. That was an approximation. Or, I mean, that wasn't an approximation, but people saying, oh, you don't have BSD jails on Linux, but you could use a cheroot. That's the approximation. And there's really been nothing quite like a BSD jail on Linux until LXC containers, things like that. Like, that's sort of the best approximation of a BSD jail. And whether or not that's really the same thing, you know, you could still have debates over. So feature parity doesn't exist. I don't believe that it's ever quite existed in the POSIX world. But open source principles still apply. The code is open, so it's technically portable. Quotes around technically, like it's technically portable. That's not the best answer in the world. I mean, still, systemd still exists, and it's still very Linux-specific, and if people start building on top of systemd, then the software that they're writing that depends on systemd becomes Linux-exclusive as well, which just starts to rob BSD of all kinds of potential cool stuff, and that doesn't seem like a good thing. But at the same time, it's kind of silly to tell a developer, well, you can't use systemd. Don't hook into systemd, because that means that the BSD people can't use your software, and you wouldn't want that. Well, they probably wouldn't want that, and yet at the same time, systemd does cover a lot of ground, and if it has features that are that nice that developers are being attracted to using it, then why wouldn't they want to build on top of that? I'm not saying we're quite at the full meritocracy ideal yet, but in a way, that's kind of what we're doing here. We're saying that developers are going to be attracted to the things that make life easier, and users are going to be attracted to things that make life easier. I mean, you can't imagine how nice some of the features of systemd really start to shine when you start messing around with containers. Like, it's a really, really nice, there's a lot of supportive technology within systemd to make containers just kind of do all kinds of cool things. You can get all kinds of information from them and monitoring and stuff like that. It's really quite nice. I mean, not that I know what that's like outside of systemd. I'm just saying, with systemd, there's a lot of integration there that you might not know about if you don't do that sort of thing on a day-to-day basis. And then there are, I'm sure, other features in systemd that are quite nice, because you do see people hooking into it for things like, I think, I don't know, does PackageKit somehow hook into systemd? I could be making that up. But, you know, there are things out there that people are using out of systemd that you have to assume are worth using, because otherwise they wouldn't bother, you would think. So I'm going to pause here again. So I've paused from Deep Geek's email, and now I've paused from my pause. So we're two pauses in, just to sort of help you orient yourself. So I'm going to tell you a little story real quick about when I was a sysadmin at a place, and I was working as a sysadmin, and it came to my attention that people were accessing their work systems outside of work using different tools that the internet provided. I mean, there was you know, things like Dropbox or probably Google Drive. I don't know if that actually existed at the time. I don't remember. And LogMeIn, which is a sort of a, I don't know exactly what it is, I forget, but it's like a VPN over HTTP sort of thing, maybe. So there were methods that people were using, and this phenomenon is called shadow IT. It means it refers to times in an organization when users sort of develop their own systems to provide for what they think they need or what they feel like they need. And it's great because it reflects on users sort of their ingenuity and problem solving ability. And it's also hugely problematic because that there is supposed to be a single point of authority when it comes to the infrastructure of a business, of a company, of an organization. And with shadow IT, you lose out on that. You just have a bunch of different people doing whatever they want. And in some cases, that can be really, really bad. If there's, you know, you wouldn't want someone at, I don't know, a doctor's office or something implementing some kind of shadow IT so that they can work on patient records from the luxury of their own home. And then, I mean, none of that's bad, right? That seems reasonable enough. But what if the fear is that person might make an uninformed decision and use some application that isn't secure in any way, and then you've got privacy concerns because now you're potentially exposing a bunch of information through, you know, some kind of like HTTP signal rather than HTTPS or rather than some kind of VPN tunnel. So it could be problematic. And that's just one example. It could be a doctor's office, it could be banking information, who knows? Stuff you don't necessarily want exposed or potentially exposed, the IT department is supposed to be able to guard against that. So shadow IT can be very, very, well, or film information too. You wouldn't want scenes from movies leaked out that way. So anyway, shadow IT can be very, very problematic for an IT department. And the, you know, one way to combat that is to set up firewalls and things to intercept these sort of bad systems. But even though I was fairly new to sysadmining, I recognized that this was a feature request. And the organization that I was at wasn't very organized anyway, so there really wasn't any sense of what a feature request might actually look like, a formal feature request. Even though I invited people to come to me with ideas and requests and things like that, just people aren't necessarily trained to stop before they open up that Dropbox account so that they can put their work information on someone else's server so that they can then go home and work on it. You know, they don't think, okay, well, I should pause and I should go ask if there's some official way to do this. Because to them, it feels very natural. It's just what they would do anyway at home, so why wouldn't they do it at work? Now, that brings up, this, by the way, brings up a whole bunch of thoughts about how a company or an organization should be handling sort of IT in the first place. But the place that I was at was not the place to formulate that. It was very poorly managed. And so I saw the shadow IT as a feature request, and I took it upon myself to throw up a Nextcloud install so that people had a reliable way to access things from home, and I started working on a VPN connection and so on. So there were a bunch of things that you know, sort of the evidence of these things made me realize, okay, that's a feature request. I will now try to resolve the shadow IT issues by providing official avenues to do the same thing, and then broadcast that those official avenues are available and that they should be used over these other solutions. That's my little story from the trenches. And now I'm going to unpause and get back to systemd. Systemd, I think, if you are a hardline Unix philosophy, everything should be split, nothing should ever be tightly coupled, and so on, or you just happen not like systemd for whatever reason, or you can't run systemd because you're on BSD, I think the solution to the systemd problem, quote, systemd problem, close quote, so this problem, the solution isn't to say that systemd must die, because obviously people are using systemd. Now you can look at the major distributions and some of the not so major distributions, and most of them are using systemd at this point. And you can say that that's some kind of conspiracy, that Red Hat has bought the allegiance of lots of developers all over the world or something, or that Red Hat has so many developers that they sort of represent some kind of sort of weighted market share of what people want, and since they're being paid to love systemd, then that's what they're using, or whatever, you know. Or you could blame Red Hat and SUSE combined, or Canonical and SUSE and Red Hat. Of course, Canonical had their own system for a while. They were going against systemd, and then they decided to go with systemd. So that's interesting. And then Debian, you know, you got lots of groups, big groups that don't traditionally collaborate or corroborate, and they're all using systemd. So even if you're a conspiracy theorist and believe that it's all some kind of Illuminati sort of master plan to destroy Unix, which, by the way, is ridiculous, I think. But, you know, I've learned better to argue against conspiracy theories. That's just a path best left alone, actually. So I'm not going to do that. And it doesn't matter anyway, even if it is a conspiracy, even if it is true, it doesn't matter. The point is, so I'll give it to you. I'll say, yes, it's a conspiracy. So whether it is or is it, it's not, systemd is being used in a lot of distributions, and people are using it. The solution to that, I believe, is to treat that as a shadow init system and come up with alternatives, or go into the code that is relying on systemd that's preventing your OS from using that thing, and code around it. Develop things that provide the same information that systemd could provide that would then enable those applications to run, and so on. So in other words, I don't believe that the solution is to dismantle systemd, because I don't think that's, well, I don't think it's productive. I mean, it isn't, right? It is literally destructive. It's saying, I see the huge structure that you've built that's obviously working really, really well for a lot of people, and I want to break it and get rid of it. That is literally not productive. So the more productive way, like, again, I'm speaking very literal here, like literal productivity, The literal productive way to get around systemd would be to build the alternatives that you need for there to be feature parity or compatibility or portability once again. And that's a tall order, and it's easy for me to sort of theorize that that's what we should all do if we're trying to avoid sort of systemd eating the init system and all of the open source software. That is a tall order, and I don't know, you know, I don't know what that means. I don't know what that would entail. But I do know that BSD has like literally implemented a Linux compatibility layer quite a while ago now. So, you know, there's already been work to sort of bring things back to the center. And in my mind, from where I am as a Linux user, I'm really enjoying the leaps and bounds that Linux has made within the past 10 years or whatever. And so it's very difficult for me to sort of say, well, yeah, we should slow that down and make sure that we're staying feature for feature the same as BSD. And I don't believe that BSD would want that really either. I'm not saying that BSD people necessarily appreciate systemd, you know, like that. I get that because it doesn't work on their OS. So yeah, I see that. But I just don't, yeah, I think that the differences are good and that the connections need to be made to make them negligible rather than any kind of idea of sort of destroying the differences and making them the same again, because that's not really what we want ever. I think we want that separation. We want that, well, we want to avoid the monoculture. We really do. And I realize that POSIX is not a monoculture, that it's just the portability specifications. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of room where differences can be very good. And ultimately, that might be something that we really appreciate for one reason or another. And I don't know what those reasons will be. I'm just saying, at some point, we might appreciate that there are major differences between the two systems. And I think it's important to kind of keep those differences. Those are our strengths. Okay, I've unpaused Deep Geek's emails, and I'm going to continue down his tests with Debian. So he says, I got curious, this is Deep Geek again, I got curious and tested a few things on Debian. I thought you and your listeners would be interested. Debian is unique, as far as I know, as it officially supports systemd's init system, as well as sysvinit. However, systemd itself, that is to say, its core, is automatically installed. I decided to spin up a test cheroot to check a few things out. I discovered that issuing the command apt-get remove systemd did remove systemd. It also automatically removed systemd-init and installed sysv-init. I noted that runit can also be installed, but it does not seem to be included in the automatic system. Here is where I put a package manager hold on systemd. I proceeded to install Firefox ESR. This did it without a problem. I then test installed the following browsers: Conqueror, Chromium, Midori, Epiphany, and Falcon. Those browsers asked for systemd or systemd's PAM module as recommended in the apt package system, but installed without them. I noticed that the following desktop environments would have installed without systemd if I'd gone through it: KDE, LXQt, Mate, XFCE. However, GNOME's dependencies, especially on its required component GDM3, that's the GUI login manager, required systemd and would not install without it. I'm with you in the attitude of, if systemd's functions are useful to developers, okay, but I am also BSD curious enough to keep track of what's installable without systemd. Perhaps someday, somebody, as a goof, will create a Linux distro that uses all systemd modules as its base. That should get the community in a roar. And that's the end of the email. So this is Klaatu again. So that's a great email. Really interesting points raised, obviously, because I talked about just the first paragraph for a couple of minutes, more than a couple of minutes. And I think There's a lot going on with System D. I think we all see that. There are lots of reasons that people don't like it. There are obviously reasons that people do. As I've said, developers are clearly enjoying the things that System D is making possible. Different types of users are enjoying System D features. And so it's silly, I think, to say, well, we can't have System D in the world either because I don't like it, which it, that's not me actually saying that. As I've said before, I actually quite like systemd. I'm saying it's silly to say we can't have systemd just because somebody doesn't like it or some group of people doesn't like it. We can't say we can't have systemd just because BSD will never adopt it, and therefore if BSD and Linux both can't have the thing, then we can't have the thing. That's silly, because otherwise we wouldn't have a lot of different things. So the difference in our open source operating systems can be viewed as a strength. It is all open source. There are ways to bridge these gaps. It's just a matter of people figuring out the best way to do that. You can believe that a developer has sort of an innate obligation to ensure that their open source code is as abstracted as possible. And architecturally, that might be really good. Or you can say, well, build what you can build and trust that other people will swoop in behind you and either make the code more abstract or build the bridge or insert the shim or whatever they need to do to provide what your software thinks. You know, all of these things are architectural issues. And in open source, because we have developers coming in from so many directions, it's kind of one of the things that we just, that's kind of built into open source, is that sometimes you get someone who just doesn't know about this other connector, and so they build their own, or so they build it to a different connector when you wanted it really to go to that connector. And so you have to rewire it sometimes. You have to create a new branch with a rewiring, or you have to make a new configuration, or something happens, and those connections have to be made. I don't see that as a bad thing, and I think that if we as an open source community pretend like we can't handle this, then we're exposing a serious weakness of the open source philosophy, more so than systemd itself. Sure, systemd oversteps its bounds. Sure, it tightly couples things that should not rely on each other. Fine. But we have to be resilient enough as a community to be able to handle that. And I think we are. That's the good news. I mean, it's happening. It's happening right now as we speak. We see we see distributions providing different init systems. We see different distributions making it possible to install stuff that, you know, normally supposedly wouldn't be possible. And for the record, I think that some of the things that DeepGeek was talking about there at the very end of his email, that's not a systemd issue anyway. That's a package management issue. If a browser doesn't actually need systemd to work, then it shouldn't be insisting that it needs systemd to work. That isn't systemd, that's the packaging scheme, whether it's the packager who put systemd in as a requirement, even though as a runtime requirement, even though it's not, or whether it's just too much, you know, the structure of package managers being too reliant on what a definition of a dependency is. I don't know. I don't use Debian enough to really be able to analyze that. But I mean, RPM and DNF have the same issue. You know, they, as far as they know, systemd is a central component, a core component of the system, and you cannot remove it really very easily, at least not within the RPM system. Can you redirect stuff? Sure, you can. But I mean, it isn't graceful. But again, that isn't systemd. That is a distribution issue. And whether it's an issue or a feature is up to you. I tend to think that it's an issue. I don't think that I would build something with quite that many requirements. I feel like the init system should be one of the many components that users should be able to choose for themselves. But that's my feeling, and if you're building a stable distribution where you want to minimize variables, I've talked about this before, you simply have to limit the scope of what you support. And that is a completely fair model of support. I remember this in a, you know, really small compared to a big project like Fedora or Red Hat or Debian or whatever. I feel like back when I was doing a lot of work with post-production places and building systems for that, it was right around the time that FFmpeg had sort of been forked off into libav, and it was brutal trying to think of supporting both libav and FFmpeg was just not a good time. That was not fun. And I got to the point where I just said, FFmpeg is what I will support. And if you want to run libav for some reason, then you can do that. But the minute you run into trouble, I'm just going to uninstall libav and install FFmpeg, because that's what I've tested. That's what I can sort of vouch for. Those are the command options that are valid and so on. And as much as libav tried to sort of claim that it was a project that was, I remember them saying essentially that it was a drop-in replacement for FFmpeg, but it wasn't. The command options started to stray from one another, and it caused real issues. Now, imagine that for an init system. It's understandable. But hey, in the end, the point is that we have an embarrassment of wealth here in open source when it comes to choice. If you want to choose one init system over another, you can. And admittedly, that might mean that you don't get to run the exact distribution that you think you want to run. I don't personally know off the top of my head right now where I would turn if I wanted an RPM distribution without systemd, for instance. But certainly there are Debian-based distributions without systemd, and there's obviously Slackware and Gentoo and Crux and a couple of others, I think. So we have a lot of opportunity to choose between what we arbitrarily like. We don't have to justify what we like because nobody's asking. We can do whatever we want for any reason that we want. And that's a great place to be, and it's starkly, starkly different than what choices are offered in the proprietary world, where right now all I can hear about on the tech sites is how you have to upgrade to Windows 11 or something right now. I don't know why, but that seems to be the general consensus is that everything is falling apart and you have to go to 11, and 11 is the worst place to be. I'm not really sure. I don't understand it. And then, of course, in the Mac world, people just do whatever they're told whenever they're told to. They seem to love anything that happens, except those who don't and then threaten to leave and then never leave. That's the life cycle in proprietary software, and it's just so miserable. I mean, it really is. I don't mean that in a condescending way. It's just, I've been there, and it's a miserable place to be, where you have no out. And in open source, we do, and I really appreciate that, and I'm not willing to give that up. And if you think that systemd is forcing you to give that up, then change away from systemd, and you'll be surprised at how rich an experience you can have outside of systemd. And if you're not sure, try a systemd distro sometime. You'll be surprised at how rich an experience you can have inside of systemd. It goes both ways. It's all open source, and it's a developing project. Everything's always a developing project. That's exciting in itself. I think that's everything I've got to say about these subjects. I'm not really sure if there was a clear train of thought there, but somehow it all made sense to me as I was saying it. Next time we're going to talk about RCS and probably Ruby. See you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening, and keep the source open.
Okay, I'll do it. But afterwards, I'm leaving for my vacation. Definitely, irrevocably, and finally.